Political leaders, advocates, and medical experts continue to weigh in on Friday's Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade. Earlier this week, Duke University hosted a panel of medical and legal experts to discuss that topic, including Dr. Jonas Swartz, a professor of obstetrics whose research focuses on health equity. Swartz says it's common for pregnant women to have complications that make abortion a safer option, making abortion bans a risky proposition for mothers and a difficult challenge for doctors.
What degree of medical risk is enough that you decide that it is a medical emergency? You know, what do you define as a threat to maternal life? Is it a 1% risk of death? Is it a 30% risk of death? Is it a 50% risk of death? Do you have to wait for someone to be actively dying, actively having their organs shut down or have a life-threatening infection before you can intervene? Or if you suspect that those things would happen, can you intervene before that? You know, I think we are trained to provide evidence-based medical care. And this is the only circumstance where I can think of that states are taking away our ability to provide best evidence-based care. We know how to care for these patients, and we know how to help them make decisions that are best for their lives and for their health. You know, I think that the other risk is we know that people will still need abortions, even if it is illegal in their state. And so people will seek abortion and get abortions, even if it is illegal in their state. Some people will be able to obtain abortions through safe means by traveling to other states. They may be able to safely order medication pills that are the same pills that we would use if we were performing a medication abortion on the internet. They may be able to get an online consultation to do medication abortion remotely. But other people will resort to unsafe means for abortion. And that means that we are going to be seeing more people in our emergency departments or in our clinics who have, you know, incomplete abortions or infections and may have complications related to that. And so I think we're really putting women's lives at peril or pregnant people's lives at peril by taking away this right.
That's Jonas Swartz speaking there. Also weighing in was law professor Neil Siegel, who said while some anti-abortion advocates have suggested banning pregnant individuals from traveling to other states for abortion procedures, he believes that right, at least, is not in jeopardy.
I expect there are 5 votes on the Supreme Court for the proposition that states cannot prohibit their residents from going out of state to obtain an abortion. But I can't tell you that there's a precedent on point. The court has not, to my knowledge, decided a case in which interstate travel is not simply banned, but banned for certain purposes. So there are arguments on the other side about what the scope of the right to travel is. But if I were betting, I would bet that there are 5 votes on even this court to restrict the state's ability to do that. And as a practical matter, I think it would be extremely difficult in most circumstances, although not necessarily all, for a state to go about enforcing such a ban, given that the sister state that allows access to abortion is not going to be cooperating with any kind of criminal law enforcement. Now, having said that, doctors who help patients travel out of state to obtain abortions, who is in charge of the medical licensing boards within the state that bans abortion? What kind of rules are they imposing? What kind of restrictions are they imposing on doctors? I think that's something that physicians are going to need to look out for in the days and months and years ahead.
That's Neil Siegel speaking there. Get more highlights from that Duke University panel on our website, chapelboro.com. Over now to Raleigh, where State House and Senate leaders unveiled their budget proposal for the next fiscal year that begins on Friday, with votes scheduled for later this week. That budget proposal includes a 3.5% pay raise for most state employees, 4.2% on average for teachers, an extra $1 billion in education spending, nearly $200 million redirected to the Highway Fund to address declining gas tax revenue, and $1 billion reserved in a special fund to address the possible impacts of inflation. NNO reports it also includes funds to attract an unnamed computer chip manufacturer to Chatham County. More controversially, the budget also includes more money for private school vouchers, and it does not include Medicaid expansion, though more on that in just a second. No word yet from Governor Roy Cooper on whether he supports the budget or not. That budget plan doesn't include Medicaid expansion, but the state House did sign off on a separate Medicaid expansion bill yesterday by a nearly unanimous vote. Democrats and Republicans are now united in favor of Medicaid expansion after a partisan battle that stretched out more than a decade, but there is a lot of difference between the House's plan and the Senate's plan, so it's still not clear that any Medicaid expansion plan will pass at all, at least not in the near future. Negotiations are still ongoing. Also in Raleigh, a state House committee signed off yesterday on a bill that would bring more transparency to the meetings of the Council of State. Among other things, that bill would require the governor to convene the council publicly when asking for consent to issue emergency declarations. Back locally, a big award this week for former Chapel Hill Mayor Howard Lee, honored by the Southern Regional Education Board, Educational Board, with the inaugural Jack Hill Champion of Education Award. That comes just a week after he and his wife Lillian were on hand as Chapel Hill Transit headquarters were dedicated in their name. Chapel Hill Mayor Pam Heminger says the town has a policy not to name buildings after living individuals, but in this case, they made an exception.
It was so important to do this because we really did want them to know how much and how grateful we were. I was very sad that Reverend Seymour wasn't here to see this. He'd been advocating for a long time to do something in honor of Howard and Lillian, constantly advocating, and thought, you know, we need to do this. We just need to do this. And it was so important, and we've been celebrating different transit deliverables this last year, so this was really an important thing to do. They both contributed to community, and it was a great reminder that people came here to our community not sure if they would be welcome or not, and at first weren't feeling that welcome, and managed to rise above that and pull people together, become the mayor, become the leader of the hospital school system, and really bridge that gap and show that we can work together and make things happen. And it was a wonderful tribute. It really, really was. It made me proud of this community showing up and speaking up. And it was just delightful to hear the Lees share their experience, and loved hearing the bus drivers from our first bus system. It was a really wonderful ceremony, and I'm so glad we did this.
That's Chapel Hill Mayor Pam Heminger speaking there. Time now for sports, brought to you this hour by All About Insurance. Big changes coming next year to the way the ACC schedules football. Starting in 2023, the ACC will be eliminating the Atlantic and Coastal divisions and moving to a new scheduling model with every team in the standings together. Each team will have three primary opponents that they'll play every year, and then the other 10 teams they'll face twice over a four-year period, once at home and once away. UNC's three primary opponents for the next 4 years will be Duke, NC State, and Virginia. You can head to our website, chapelburg.com, to get a link to a complete list of UNC's future opponents through 2026. By the way, even though the two-division model is going away, the ACC will still have a conference championship game. It'll just be the top two teams in the standings after the regular season meeting in that final. Over to basketball now, where summer practice gets underway this week for UNC. Two of Carolina's big men are still recovering from injury, including Armando Bacot, still healing from an ankle sprain he suffered in the Final Four, and incoming freshman Jalen Washington, who's still on the road back from a torn ACL. Here's head coach Hubert Davis.
Armando, he told me yesterday he was 77%. In terms of his ankle. The percentages these kids that give out are hilarious. I don't know how they get to those percentages, how they can self-diagnose themselves, but it's getting a lot better. And me personally, having gone through ankle sprains, you're better, but you don't feel like 100% for maybe 5 months or so. And so every day he's playing pickup, he's doing individual workouts. Jalen can do everything except 5-on-5, and so he's doing all individual workouts, 5-on-0, and doing running, doing strength and conditioning, and he'll be able to do 5-on-5 right at the beginning when everyone comes back for the fall semester. And so I'm really excited about him. I know he got to miss his senior year of high school, but he's a really, really talented player, and I'm really excited about playing him out there on the floor. He's going to be great next year.
That's Hubert Davis speaking there. Elsewhere in sports, the U.S. National Women's Lacrosse Team gets underway today at the World Championship Games up in Towson, Maryland. Team USA's head coach is UNC's own Jenny Levy, and you'll recognize the names of six former Tar Heels on the roster: Molly Hendrick, Allie Mastroianni, Marie McCool, Emily Perros, Emma Trenchard, and Kaylee Waters. World Championships occur every 4 years, and Team USA is on a winning streak. They've won the last three titles dating back to 2009. And in baseball, another win yesterday for the Durham Bulls, 6-2 at Charlotte. That was game one of a six-game series. Game two is tonight at 7 o'clock.